How did you find Nolan's departure? Did you find it as a firing or a resignation? And what would it mean for the conflict in Ukraine?
I think it was a resignation. It probably had a number of reasons behind it. One was her disappointment at not becoming the Deputy Secretary of State, which is a position that Kurt Campbell has assumed. But I believe also that she may have lost some sort of policy debate over Ukraine. she has been a proponent of using Ukraine to weaken and isolate Russia, to punish Russia, if you will. And this has involved advocating long-range strikes into Russian territory. Many in the administration in Washington regard this as too risky. It obviously draws Russian retaliation, and it risks a wider war. And I think she was advocating this right up to the end. I believe that it may have had something to do with her decision to depart. At any event, she has assumed a position at Columbia University. Now, she's not, she's only in her early 60s. She's not disappeared from the American scene. She and the neoconservative group that she epitomizes, represents, have not ceased to have exercise influence by any means. There may have been other issues that involved her resignation, for example, disagreements over the weakening Biden position in support of Israel. But I suspect it did have to do with European affairs.
In your opinion, how much of this kind of strange behavior that we have been witnessing in Europe, Macron talking about sending troops, French troops to Ukraine, and German Bundeswehr talking about using Taurus missiles to hit Crimean Bridge, these kind of strange behavior that we have been witnessing, how much of these type of activities in Europe were coming from Nuland?
I think it's a reaction to the, it's a desperate reaction to the deterioration of Ukraine's position in this war. Ukrainian defense line has crumbled. The Ukrainians are retreating under Russian pressure. The Russian offensive is advancing. Ukrainian retreat is not terribly well organized. It's very costly in terms of casualties. And I think there is a desperate search for countermeasures, ways of restoring the Ukrainian position in this war. You know, oddly enough, nobody seems to be advocating a negotiation, which would be the logical thing. I think as time goes on, Ukraine's bargaining position is deteriorating, not improving. And this, you know, it would have been far better had Ukraine negotiated in 2023, or late 2022, actually, was probably the high point. But it is not related directly to the resignation of Victoria Nuland, I believe. But she may have resigned for the same reason that you hear this talk from Macron, who is talking not about deep strikes into Russia, but about troops in Ukraine, a common European security defense, if you will, something the French have always advocated, their leadership of a European defense effort. The German discussion does seem to be more consonant with Ms. Nuland's position. Again, I think this is a spontaneous reaction to a very serious security dilemma that has arisen from Ukraine's failures.
If you remember, she was pushing this idea of attacking Crimea and Crimean Bridge. She was trying to force Europeans in that direction. Do you think that this resignation would be some sort of relief for European leaders?
They'd have to speak for themselves. I think many of them have found the American neoconservative aggressive position objectionable, have not agreed with it. Europe is much more cautious for many reasons, reflecting European history. Europe is composed of very pugnacious states that have learned that if you attack another state, you pay a price. The United States is separated from the world by two wide oceans and has neighbors which are not threatening. So the mentality is very different. But I think the issue for Europeans now, as it has been for a long time, given American political trends, the collapse of support for the war in Ukraine in many respects in the United States, and the fact that NATO, which was once a purely defensive alliance, has been often repurposed to be an offensive alliance, going quite far out of Europe in Afghanistan and Libya. And of course, there was an attempt to involve it in Iraq, which did not succeed. Now there's an effort to involve it in East Asian security issues. I think Europeans are beginning to focus more on the requirement for their own defense by themselves. And you see defense budgets increasing. What you have not seen yet, but which I believe we will see, is a drive by Europeans to enhance transnational defense cooperation. Europe is much less than the sum of its parts in military terms, in part because each European country insists on producing its own weaponry rather than cooperating. Now, there are exceptions to that, but that is the general pattern. There is no great common market in any sector of the European economy, but particularly none in the defense sector, as there is in the United States. One state is not able to build barriers against another in the American market. In Europe, they can. So I think we're going to see a lot of issues come to a head because it does now look as though Mr. Trump will be the next president in the United States. And he's been quite clear that he does not support a continued American role in the front lines of defending Europe.
Do you think that at the end of the day, she is accepting that Ukrainian project has failed because she was working on this project for more than a decade?
Well, I think you have to ask yourself what her purpose was, or the neoconservative purpose more generally, because you can make much too much of Victoria Nuland. I think she was a very effective Washington official. Whether she was a diplomat is another question. But in the American capital, she was a formidable force. And as I said, I don't believe she's disappeared from our politics. However, having said all of that, her purpose has not never been to defend Ukraine or to save Ukrainians from the consequences of war. She has always been prepared to fight the Russians to the last drop of Ukrainian blood, not ours. And so whether she sees this enterprise as having failed or not is an open question. I suspect she took the conversation between the various German generals talking about long-range strikes into Russia and attacks on the Kerch Bridge as vindication of her views. This is not over yet. This debate has not finished. Mr. Macron, when he proposed putting troops in Ukraine, was immediately shouted down by other members of NATO. That was not taken, it was not agreed to. Of course, there are troops from NATO in Europe, in Ukraine, clandestinely, but he was proposing an open intervention. I don't think anybody has the stomach for that. Anyway, I don't think Ms. Nuland has been, I don't think we've heard the last from her. I don't think the neoconservatives have been completely dismissed at this point. President Biden continues with policies that are based on their theories, that are very congenial to Ms. Nuland, even though it's becoming more and more obvious that this war has to be brought to an end before Ukraine has much further losses than it's already had.
The Serbian president said that NATO will send its troops to Ukraine to fight directly. Do you think at the end of the day, we're going to have some sort of confrontation, direct confrontation between NATO forces and Russia?
I don't believe that, because I believe the Russians will retaliate forcefully for any such direct conflict. I think it's quite remarkable that they have been as restrained as they have been in the face of what is obviously an intervention right on their border, both in the Ukrainian civil war between the hardline nationalists of Western Ukraine and the Russian-speaking Ukrainians of the East, and in the proxy war between the U.S. and Russia since 2022. And so I don't think that is correct. I'm sure the president of Serbia reflects some Russian opinion. Serbia has always been very close to Russia and remains so. So I think this represents a Russian fear. And we hear from people in Russia, like Mr. Medvedev, who's very hardline, what sort of response this might draw. I think Mr. Putin is much more cautious, but he too has warned that any kind of direct intervention by the West, meaning NATO, the Western Bloc, in Ukraine would be met with an escalation by the Russians. And the Russian escalation is not a trivial matter, because Russians have a conventional force that probably cannot match NATO, although it has held its own in Ukraine. And Ukraine has had NATO-trained forces and NATO-equipped forces. But Russia relies essentially on its nuclear deterrent. And Russian nuclear doctrine does say that if there is a convincing existential threat to Russia, or Russia is losing a war to its strategic disadvantage, that it will resort to nuclear weapons. And I think this has a serious deterrent value, which is why I don't think we will see a direct intervention. If we don't see a direct, well, whether we do or don't, I think the issue now is how much more territory is Ukraine going to lose and where? You mentioned the constant moving of the parameters for defending Ukraine by the West. We won't send this, and then we do, and we won't send that, and then we do. So far, the Russians have been quite firm in maintaining the goalposts that they originally set up. But as they achieve success on the battlefield, one has to wonder whether those goalposts will not be moved. Will they now try to take this Black Sea coast, including Odessa? Now, from a military point of view, that's very difficult, because you have to basically cross the Dnieper River and come down from the north. Amphibious landings are very difficult to manage and very costly, as we know from World War II. So I think it's not easy, but we're beginning to see major gains in territory in precisely the areas from which a southern attack, an attack to the south, could be staged by the Russian army.
Zelensky recently had an interview with Fox News in which he said that nobody cares about Avdiivka. We know that Ukrainians were suffering a lot in this conflict in Avdiivka, and finally they lost Avdiivka. And it's so amazing how he sacrifices all of these people to a conflict, and he came out and says it doesn't matter for us. And the other thing that he said that it was so amazing, Ukraine doesn't have a backup plan, doesn't have a plan B. Who's going to convince Zelensky and his administration that Ukraine finally needs a plan B?
It doesn't seem to me that he can be convinced. neither he nor his government, his foreign minister, who has angrily rebutted the call of the Pope for a negotiated settlement in Ukraine, and neither of them seem to be prepared to give ground, although Ukraine is giving ground on the battlefield. So there is a disconnect between the Ukrainian position diplomatically and the Ukrainian position on the ground militarily. Now, May 20th is the end of Mr. Zelensky's formal term as president. There are a lot of indicators that there are people in Kyiv plotting some sort of coup to overthrow him. The Speaker of the Rada, the Ukrainian parliament, has said that with the end of the term, he should be the president. So I think the answer to the question you pose is that Mr. Zelensky will not be convinced, but he will, one way or another, be bypassed or set aside by other Ukrainians who see that the survival of the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian nationalists in its western part remaining in charge depends on accommodating what has happened on the ground, namely doing a deal with the Russians. Now, the problem is, of course, that given what's happened, the Russian bargaining position has steadily strengthened, and any negotiation will be on largely on Russian terms, which will be a defeat for the West and for Ukrainian ultranationalists. So politically, this is very difficult. On the other hand, I guess I would say some of us from the very beginning foresaw that Ukraine would not succeed with Western backing in taking back the Crimea, the Donbas. The Donbas region is like major Russian-speaking area of Ukraine. The government in Kyiv did everything possible to alienate those Russian speakers. Many of them took refuge in Russia. There's a very large refugee population from the Donbas in Russia. I think this has not worked out the way the followers of Stepan Bandera had hoped.
We know that Victoria Nuland was recently in Kiev to solve the problem that they were having between Zelensky and Zaluzhny. And finally, it seems that she was supporting Zelensky over Zaluzhny. Do you think that her resignation would affect the position of Zelensky in Ukraine?
Well, certainly he's lost a very strong backer in Washington. That she clearly was. And Zaluzhny, of course, as the commanding general, very familiar with what was happening on the battlefront and what was possible and what was not possible, had called for a major increase in conscription for expanding the Ukrainian armed forces with a draft. And this is politically and perhaps demographically impossible. I don't think there are very many young Ukrainians within reach of the Ukrainian state to augment the current forces in Ukraine. So Kyiv has run out of cannon fodder, if you will. And the replacement of Zaluzhny by Zelensky, with a general who has a reputation for frontal assaults, represents a kind of desperation. And even that general has found it necessary, as you indicated, to retreat from Avdiivka and to conduct a retreat more broadly across the battle lines. So this is a reality that, magical thinking can't overcome.
We know that recently at the border between Ukraine and Poland, they have been dealing with some problems because the farmers in Poland are not happy with the situation at the border with Ukraine. Let's assume that Ukraine end up to be a landlord. How Washington gonna manage these problems in that region?
Well, I have no answer to that question, but I will say that the relationship between Poland and Ukraine is complex. You are right. The closure of much of the exports from Odessa and grain exports through the Black Sea has produced a surplus of grain for export from Ukraine at prices that undercut Polish grain. So it's not surprising that Polish farmers are upset about this and oppose that trade. But more importantly, Poland is fiercely anti-Russian because of its history. Poland has invaded Russia, but more recently, the Russians occupied Poland, and it was not a happy experience for the Poles. Among other things, they lost a great deal of territory, which was given to Ukraine by Joseph Stalin. Galicia, the western region, which is the most ardently ultra-nationalist of Ukrainian regions, was once part of Poland. The Poles remember, even if people outside the region do not, that Stepan Bandera and others like him, who were part of the German Nazi SS in World War II, murdered 150,000 Poles in that very region. They also killed 250,000 Jews. When this new Ukraine makes Stepan Bandera the founding father and renames all sorts of places after him, erects statues to him, and so forth and so on, this is a grave insult and a terrible thing for the Poles to contemplate. So you have a conflict between the common anti-Russian spirit of Western Ukrainians and Poles, on the one hand, versus the opposition of Poles to those very same Western Ukrainians historically. And I think we're seeing this complexity played out. What we would do if Ukraine is, in fact, reduced to a landlocked state, I do not know. I mean, you know, that would mean, in effect, that much of what was most valuable in the Ukrainian state that became independent after the collapse of the Soviet Union will have been annexed to Russia. The Donbas is the major industrial area of Ukraine, very closely linked to the Russian economy. The other regions are major grain-producing regions, Kherson, for example, and Zaporizhia. And I think what would be left would be a very weakened, impoverished, and probably still very corrupt state, which would be trying to get into the European Union, which would insist on reforms, because the European Union's accession process has been very effective in helping those seeking to join the EU to overcome domestic problems like corruption, the absence of the rule of law, human rights issues, and so forth. But the demands on that Ukraine, that rump Ukraine, from Brussels would be very, very large. I don't know what the United States would do about that. You know, I think really we are heading into an era in which Europe, in its own interest, must become more independent of American influence, more self-sufficient, both in the defense area and politically, and Ukraine would be a test of that.
The western part of Ukraine, we have various ethnicities. If at the end of the day it ends up to be a landlocked, that's going to affect the western part.
This is the essence of the problem that the Ukrainian state confronts and has created. Let's remember that the civil war in Ukraine began after the 2014 Euromaidan coup, when the new Ukrainian government overrode the previous Ukrainian constitution's guarantees of ethnic and linguistic minority rights. It stripped not just the Russian speakers, but the Hungarian speakers, the Romanian speakers, and the speakers of many other languages, because Ukraine is a multi-ethnic state, or was, of their right to use their own languages for official purposes or for purposes of educating their children. This led to the revolt in the Donbass. It is a matter of great concern to Ukraine's neighbors. What we have heard Mr. Orban, for example, the president of Hungary, speak about the 150,000 Hungarians who are citizens of Ukraine and who have been denied their rights. Now, these rights, to go back to the pan-European context, are guaranteed not just by the former Ukrainian constitution, but by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. These are rights that European culture and civilization has come to demand. So, for example, when Austria was neutralized and troops of the Soviet Union, United States, France, and Germany, and Britain, rather, withdrew from Austria in the mid-1950s, one of the requirements was that the Slovene, Italian, Hungarian, and other minority populations in Austria be accorded exactly the rights that the original Ukrainian constitution guaranteed for similar people in Ukraine, and which have been taken from them. So any European Union accession process that Ukraine, in whatever is left of it, when all this is over, undergoes is going to involve guarantees for the rights of these people, that is, non-Ukrainian national, Ukrainian citizens who are not of Ukrainian origin. I think this is a big problem, but I don't believe there is any room for further secession. I think these minorities, there will not be territorial changes in favor of these countries, as opposed to the Russians, who were driven to make a war and will reap the benefits of that territorially.
When you look at the guy who's replacing Victoria Nuland, John Bass, do you think that he's going to make some sort of changes in the policy in Ukraine, or are you going to find him in the same line as Victoria Nuland was?
I really have no idea what his personal position is on issues. I think one of the problems with interpreting where the influence of policy officials in any government is that we are all bound when we are serving in that government to support the existing policy, whether we believe in it or not. Now, if the contradiction between our personal beliefs and the policy becomes sufficiently extreme, as may have happened in the case of Victoria Nuland, we don't know, then resignation is an option. But normally, a government official is expected to practice what communists, Leninists called democratic centralism. That is, you may dissent from a policy when it is being discussed and proposed, but once it is approved, you must support it. So I don't know what Mr. Bass's position is. And I think, as I said earlier with regard to Ms. Nuland, it's possible to make too much of any individual in this equation. It is very clear that Joe Biden, our president, is very sympathetic to the neoconservative position. He has a neoconservative in his as his Secretary of State. He has a neoconservative, apparently, as his National Security Advisor. He was open to the views of Victoria Nuland for a long time. I don't know. He is ultimately the decision maker, and I don't know what he will decide. So I would not put too much emphasis on Mr. Bass unless, you know, it turns out that he is somehow a fanatic supporter of anti-Russian policies. I suspect he is not, but I don't know.
We know that Biden and his administration is trying so hard to convince Republicans to send more aids to Ukraine. And so far, they were not successful in doing that. Trump has a good chance. It seems that all Republicans are supporting him. If he wins, what does it mean for the case of Ukraine?
So I think the problem really is, and Mr. Trump is very likely to be the Republican nominee, almost certain, I think, at this point. Of course, he could die of a cheeseburger or something, this is possible. Barring that, I think he will be the nominee, the candidate, and he's very likely to win. I think almost certain to win, for various reasons having to do with the collapse of enthusiasm and support for Mr. Biden, who tried very hard to rekindle enthusiasm during his State of the Union address, but I don't think was seen by the groups that object to him within the Democratic Party as meeting their demands. I think we will probably get Mr. Trump as president. He has been very clear, not only that he does not support this war in Ukraine, but that he wishes to disentangle the United States from NATO. He sees NATO apparently as a sort of business operation where you pay for protection or you don't get it. He's openly said that he would not honor Article 5 of the NATO Treaty if the country that was threatened by Russia, why we only think about Russia as a threat is an interesting question, was not fully paid up in accordance with the 2% of GDP rule or some other arbitrary standard. The danger, I mean, we know what he will attempt to do. The danger is that he will do it in an abrupt and totally destabilizing manner. Because whatever one says, he has no reputation for diplomatic finesse or much attention to the need for a dialogue and consultation with allies. He tends to be quite unilateral. If that is the case, then a necessary adjustment in U.S. relationships with Europe and NATO, I think is necessary, which needs to be accomplished with a process that reassures Europeans, even as it extricates Americans from some commitments, will not take place. And instead, we will have an abrupt change, which will alarm people, and the reactions will not be clear. I mean, what will the European reaction be? It's already apparent that Europeans, 32 members of NATO now, including the United States and Canada, don't agree on many things. So you have Slovak views, Hungarian views, Turkish views, which are all quite different, Italian views, German views, French views. There's not much coherence. And a shock like an American disentanglement from NATO would produce something like a kaleidoscopic change, I think. You don't know where the pieces would end up. So this is a danger. Mr. Biden, if he is reelected, will continue, I believe, with a Cold War-based policy, anti-Russian, seeing NATO not as a mechanism for transatlantic cooperation, but as an adjunct to U.S.-Russian confrontation, as an instrument of American hegemony in Europe. Mr. Trump seems to be tired of hegemony. So this is all very interesting quite unpredictable because in the end it involves American voters rather than rational foreign policy considerations. And we don't know where the voters will be in November or whether these two old men will still be alive to contest the election.
Do you think the European Union is willing or capable of supporting Ukraine without the United States?
No, I don't believe that. I mean, that actually is what Mr. Macron is hinting at or trying to accomplish, a very, very long-standing French goal. I think there's some merit in it. The Western European Defense Force concepts have come and gone. They've never developed anything into anything. I think one of the possibilities before us in the longer term, assuming there is a process by which European-American relations are adjusted, is that NATO could be Europeanized, meaning that it could become commanded by a European, with the United States remaining a member, but shifting to support rather than leadership. We need to keep, we in the United States, need to keep our hand in Europe, because we have the experience of the 20th century in which, on two or maybe three occasions, if you count the Cold War, Europeans managed to unbalance affairs in Europe involving Russia and their own internal divisions, a very powerful Germany, to such an extent that we had to cross the Atlantic and restore the balance. And we did not want to do that in World War I. Woodrow Wilson took us into it in the end. We did not want to do it in World War II. It took a Japanese attack on the United States and the foolish declaration of war by Hitler on the United States to take us into Europe in a war that was already over 2 years old, from which we had remained separate. The Cold War, we had more to do with igniting, I agree. But the fact is that what this demonstrates is that there is a common geopolitical zone which unites Europe and North America. And we are essential participants in European security affairs for several reasons. First, we have to balance the Russians. Now, the Russians don't deny that that is the case. They were prepared to work with NATO as members of the NATO-Russia Council after the Cold War. We also need to be in NATO because without an American presence, a very powerful Germany begins to threaten the interests of other members of the European Union, and France, Italy, Britain. Of course, Britain has left the European Union, a very foolish move on its part. So Europe is not united as it was. Still, I think there are reasons, many reasons, for Europeans to want the United States to continue to be active in Europe. But I think the French are probably right. It's time for the United States to step back from this. You know, after all, it's three quarters of a century since Europe was liberated from the Nazis by the Russians and us. And it is the case that European countries are prosperous. They are effective in their funding of their own defense, although it would help greatly if they cooperated more with each other. They spend four times as much as the original Russian defense budget, twice as much as the current budget. They don't get what they should from that because they don't cooperate enough. An American withdrawal under whatever circumstances, to whatever extent, would energize Europeans to take charge of their own destiny again and organize themselves to play an independent role, not just in their own sphere, but globally, which I think would be greatly welcomed by other countries. This would be a major step toward true multipolarity, which your own country and others want.
How did you find the Tucker Carlson interview with Vladimir Putin?
I thought Mr. Putin came across as very sober, rational, a strategic thinker. I noted earlier that he does not appear to have moved the goalposts in Ukraine. He continues to espouse the same ambition, same lack of ambition, if you will, same objectives that he did in December 2021 when he demanded a negotiation on three issues. First, the neutralization of Ukraine, second, European security architecture, and third, the restoration of ethno-linguistic rights for Russians in Ukraine. In other words, the restoration of the Minsk Accords. I don't think he's changed his position. What I fear is that as the Russian military move forward in Ukraine, that he will move the goalposts. I mean, he would, it would be very easy for him, given the way he sees the history of Ukraine, which he outlined at great length, probably very boringly for many people. I thought it was very interesting to hear his viewpoint. I think he might very well conclude that Odessa was a Russian city founded by Catherine the Great. It was always Russian-speaking, mainly, and it should be part of this Novorossiya, or Russian zone in the Ukrainian component of the Soviet Union that became independent in 1991. So I think there's a real danger that in the absence of a negotiation, Ukraine will be further diminished. Mr. Putin will find a rationale for doing that, and that the losses that Ukraine has suffered, which have been catastrophic, will become even worse. That is an apprehension. He did not indicate that in the interview. And he did once again affirm, as he has constantly done, his willingness to negotiate a resolution of this problem. I think he has every confidence that the Russian bargaining position, as I said, has improved, not deteriorated, and that gives him even more reason to feel confident that a negotiation would yield an output, an outcome that was acceptable to Moscow. Of course, that was immediately met by the usual denunciation of negotiations by everybody but Pope Francis, who does seem to see quite clearly that would be a better way of saving Ukraine.
In this interview, when it came to the relationship between Russia and China, he said that the Chinese foreign policy is not aggressive. They're looking for some sort of compromise and cooperation. He sees that this concept is lacking in their relationship with the United States. Do you see a near future that we're going to get some sort of compromise and cooperation between Russia and the United States?
I'm afraid I don't see that in the near term. I think we have pushed the Russians and the Chinese very close together. Historically, these two countries, like Russia and Iran, have been adversaries, not allies, not even friends. And of course, we have also driven Iran and Russia together. I think part of this was directed at the Russian audience or skeptics about degree to which Russia can depend upon China. But I think it was also not inaccurate in its description of Chinese objectives. There are many objectives attributed to the Chinese, but you can look in Chinese literature, in Chinese political statements, which are quite comprehensive and readily available, and you will find no mention of much of what is feared by the West. China is reemerging as a very preeminent power, not only in its own region, but globally. That is, of course, consistent with the historical reality that for most of history, China was one-third, two-fifths of the global economy. It was the largest, arguably best-governed state on the planet. But it was also limited geographically to a certain territory. You know, to the north, there are frozen wastelands. To the west, there are deserts. To the southwest, there are mountains, Tibet and plateau and the Himalayas. And to the southeast and east, there are seas. And there are formidable cultures and countries on all of these borders. China has 14 neighbors, with whom, all of whom it has at one point or another had conflict. So China is in effect boxed in. And I don't think there's any evidence that the Chinese have any idea of expansion beyond the recovery of Taiwan for the government in Beijing. So I don't think they want more Koreans than they already have. They don't want to take Nepal. They don't want more Kazakhs or Uyghurs or Uzbeks or Tajiks or whoever to their west. And they have reached an accommodation with the Russians, which is to their advantage. I mean, they lost what is now the Russian Far East. That was originally part of the Manchu Qing Empire and part of China when the Manchus took it over. So I think what is instead happening is that the West is engaged in a psychological reaction to the reemergence of China as a country of great wealth and power after a long period in which it was not such. I mean, it was as late as 1820, it was one third of the global economy. It lost the status of the largest global economy sometime around 1850, first to the UK and then to the US. And it's now very much clearly the largest economy in every respect that's important. It produces 36% of the world's manufactures. The US does about 13-14%, about one third that. It is the global leader in a growing range of technologies. You know, clean power, meaning renewable energy, now drives 40% of GDP growth in China. And the Chinese have more than half of the world's solar power installed already. They produce 30 million automobiles a year versus our 11. It's three times as much again. You know, this is a country that is enormous, not just in population, but increasingly in terms of its economic output. And characteristically, the United States, which has a very militarized foreign policy, looks at China through a military prism and sees a menace. But if you ask yourself, are there Chinese ships off American coasts? Or there are American ships off Chinese coasts? Are there Chinese patrolling American coastlines? Or are we patrolling theirs? Do the Chinese dispute any part of American territory? We dispute a part of their territory, namely Taiwan. Do the Chinese back the Canadians in their claims against the United States in the northeast corner of the Atlantic? Or do we back Japan's claims against the Chinese in the Senkaku or Diaoyudao Islands? It's very clear that the United States is in China's face. China is not in our face. I fear that we are driving them toward a kind of more active opposition to us. But for the moment, that is not the case. So I think Mr. Putin's defense of them, while it's very self-interested on his part, actually was pretty accurate.
Just shifting the gear to the conflict in Gaza. And we know that Biden said that they're going to have some sort of ceasefire in Gaza. But right after that, Netanyahu said that despite all the pressure he's receiving from all the countries around the world, he's not willing to do that. He's not caring about anything that the world says.
Well, I think he feels very confident that Mr. Biden, on this issue at least, is very weak. He is a committed Zionist, ideologically, for reasons he's never really explained. He is dependent on Jewish plutocrats for campaign donations in a race that he is behind in, to be honest. He wants to be reelected president. He can't be reelected without that support in terms of campaign donations. The Congress, which he must deal with, is very pro-Zionist, although that is beginning to change. So I think he's confident that he can push Mr. Biden around. And so far, his confidence has been well placed. Now, Mr. Biden is under increasing pressure domestically. He may have the support of the Jewish plutocracy, but he does not have the support of many youth, Muslim Americans, others who are anti-war and believe he has brought us into yet another forever war. So he is, as he has done in Ukraine, on the opposite front. I mean, you mentioned that he would draw a red line and then retreat and retreat and retreat in terms of supplying Ukraine with weaponry. In the case of Gaza, he's drawn red line after red line about ceasefires and constantly retreated. And the most recent retreat involves the quite preposterous establishment of a port in Gaza, offshore, by the U.S. Navy, which will take 2 months to be put in place. And by the way, is entirely consistent with the long support of the United States for the siege of Gaza by Israel, because anything that is sent to that port, if there are any Palestinians left to eat it, which is a question because 2 months is a long time, given the situation in Gaza, the United States has consistently supported the siege. Anything that is sent to Gaza through that temporary port or pier will be inspected first by Israel in Cyprus. So we are still complying with the Israeli siege of Gaza. People say, well, he's challenging it. He is not challenging it. Israel has agreed to this on the grounds that, first of all, it will take a long time, probably won't do any good for the Palestinians, and second, that they will control what gets to the Palestinians. And we have seen historically that they have a very arbitrary and capricious way of denying the import of goods to Gaza. So I see this Netanyahu's confidence as pretty well founded. I think in the long run, however, Netanyahu has made a huge mistake, because in the end, Israel, like the Christian kingdoms that were established by the Crusaders in the Middle East in the Middle Ages, is entirely dependent on external support. And what he's doing is costing him the support of Americans, including a large number of Jewish Americans who are deeply distressed by what he's doing and don't support it and don't want to be identified with it, and are coming to the conclusion that Zionism is not compatible with Jewish values. It is the negation of Judaism, not the affirmation of Judaism that was promised by the atheist Jews who founded it, Herzl, Ben-Gurion, and others, who were not religious Jews. So, and they are aware that globally, the Star of David, which was once a sign of hope for rebirth from the Holocaust, is now regarded in much the same way that the Nazi swastika is, as a symbol of genocide. Now, this is not anything that anyone Jewish can be comfortable with, and people are not. Now, there are some who are diehard supporters of Israel who only hear what they want to hear when they go to the synagogue on Saturday. But, you know, I think this group is older, and it is being eclipsed by younger people who see Israel as a threat to their own security, in the sense that it justifies anti-Semitism. You know, if you can be called an anti-Semite for opposing genocide, if you can be called an anti-Semite for opposing a government that is conducting genocide, then what is the meaning of anti-Semitism? This term is being shredded of any validity and power as it, that it once had. So I think this is a very complicated situation, Mr. Netanyahu may be confident in retaining the support of Mr. Biden, but he's losing the support of the United States for Israel and the support of the world in the longer term.
Do you see some sort of appetite in the Netanyahu administration to escalate the war and maybe a direct confrontation with Hezbollah? Because that would bring the United States in the conflict.
Well, I think there's a lot of pressure for him to do that, his government to do that. And it's partly because Hezbollah has successfully intimidated and threatened a large population in northern Israel who have been evacuated or who have fled and who are very unhappy about this situation and demanding action to restore the control of the Israeli government over this territory that it has basically lost control of. I think if there is a war with Hezbollah, all indications are that as formidable as Hamas has turned out to be in Gaza, and by the way, I should make a point here. Netanyahu has just claimed that there are 13,000 fighters for Hamas who have been killed. But that is totally inconsistent with the casualty figures in Gaza, because we know that 31,000 Palestinians are dead. We know that over 21,000 of them are women and children. So basically, he's saying any Palestinian male is a member of Hamas, and which is consistent with some of the people, what some of the people in his cabinet has said. I don't think we should believe that. Hezbollah has shown historically, even before it acquired the vast rocket and missile supplies that it has, that it is far more formidable than Hamas. And I think a war with Hezbollah, first of all, it would not be supported by many Americans, because they would correctly see that it had been instigated by Israel. Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, has been very cautious. I presume this reflects Iranian advice. I don't think Iran wants a war, although Mr. Netanyahu would probably like that because he thinks it would bring the United States in on Israel's side. Nothing but cautious statements out of Tehran and out of Beirut. So I think if a war started, it would have to have been instigated by Israel for the reasons I mentioned, namely domestic pressure in Israel to restore control of the north. I hope that doesn't happen. If it does happen, I hope the United States stays out, because that would be a disaster for everybody.
When they say that that's enough, this killing has to stop.
Mr. Netanyahu is quite clear. This war keeps him in office. He wants to stay in office. He says it will go on until all of Hamas has been eliminated, which is utterly impossible. That will not happen. Hamas has been the flag carrier for Palestinian nationalism. It represents a great many people in Palestine, even if they don't agree with some of its actions. What the Israelis are doing is creating even further support for a Palestinian nationalism that is viciously anti-Israel. So it's not going to happen that the war comes to an end because Hamas is eliminated. Mr. Biden could bring this war to an end in an instant. If he suspended arms supplies to Israel, it would end. Israel cannot conduct this war without U.S. support. He is unwilling to do that. He's been unwilling to do it from the beginning, I think both for crass political reasons and because of his own racist support of Zionism. I note in that regard that one of the constituencies he seems to be losing in the United States is the African-American church, which is a very powerful institution and worthy of much respect. These are people who are real Christians, not fake ones, as they've shown repeatedly when they have been attacked. They are forgiving, they turn the other cheek, But in this case, they identify with the racist oppression of the Palestinians. And this is producing a divide in the United States that is very injurious to Mr. Biden's reelection prospects. So I think the pressure will mount on him to do what he should have done in the beginning, which is to end the arms supplies and the genocide. And I don't know at what point he will find it expedient to agree to that, or if he will. If he doesn't, I think he's doomed in November.